At this time, all participants need to be informed that the call is now being recorded. Thank you. You may now continue.
Julie, shall I do a roll call?
Yes, Glenn, that'd be lovely. Thank you so much.
On the call, we have Edmund Chun, Lisa Lennon, James Galvin, Owen Smigelski, Steve Sheng, and Julie Headland for staff. Excuse me. And we have apologies from Yeo Jiankang, Ram Mohan, Steve Metellitz, Eric Kirati Ohan, Rafik Damak, Jay Daly, and Mark Costas.
Thank you, Glenn. Very helpful. So, Edmund, as we've been doing with some of our last calls, we've been going through the set of questions that Dave Piscitello had sort of distilled for us as discussion points. And Steve Sheng has been keeping track of the various responses to those questions, and we've also been summarizing from the call. I wonder, since we have a couple of new members on our call, Edmund, if we might just maybe, Steve, maybe if you could give just a quick summary of where we are just now, and then maybe state sort of the next question that I think that we're, you know, set to begin discussion on. Would you be able to do that, Steve, briefly?
Sure. Hi, this is Steve Sheng. I'm a staff support for the working group. As Julie mentioned, Dave outlined a set of questions, and it's attached in a summary document. So basically, we've been going over these questions. The first question we discussed is, what do we require for internationalized registration data so that the user can submit or have a domain name displayed in the IDN A label format or the U label format? So basically, should we require a user, the Whois service, to be able to take the U label queries and return the relevant results? And so the working group has been deliberating on that. And from the past several meetings, it seems that the participant present at the call agreed that the Whois service should be able to submit the user should be able to submit queries both in A label and U label format. So the U label is the regular, the internationalized, and the A label is the kind of the translated ASCII correspondence of the label. And so the user should be able to submit queries in both formats and receive the corresponding replies in both A label and U label format. So that's my brief summary on the first point. Before going forward, I'd like to know if others think that I summarized it correctly or.
And Owen and Lisa, since you're new, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but do you have any questions? You haven't been able to you know, see all of the various discussion on these, but I wondered if you had any questions for Steve on that summary.
My only question is I couldn't find what the difference is between a U label and an A label query.
You mean the difference, meaning, so they are... The U label and the correspondence A label, they are equivalent, representing a domain name. So I think the discussion was we want to allow U label because it's easier for the end user to remember the U label, I mean the internationalized version of that domain name. And the A label is the ASCII translation, you know, of the U label, and sometimes machines like automated Whois clients may benefit from querying that, because those clients may not support may only support like ASCII type of queries. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Julie, I didn't have any questions at this point, but if we're going through all of the points, I did have some questions later on, which would be great. I could get those answered then, perhaps.
Great. Sure. Lisa,
sure. So let me...
I have a comment. This is, this is Jim. I have a comment. Just one point for clarity for Steve when he talks about this. I mean, we're going through here talking about requirements, and so I think that we want to be careful to not say who is servers, and in particular, we're talking about who is services. If we want to use that phrase, I guess we use who is because that's what everybody understands. But I think that's important because, you know, there, who is a protocol now. There are who is servers that are protocol now, and they do that. And we're talking about the next generation of stuff, which is not going to be directly applicable to who is servers today.
Yes. Thanks, Jim. That's a very helpful clarification. Yeah, so we're... when I say who is, I mean the who is service, not particularly the servers or the clients. That includes all of the above, I guess.
This is Julie. Owen and Lisa, did send the document to you that Steve is referring to, and Lisa certainly will give you a chance for questions as we go through it as well.
So. Let me quickly summarize the second point that we've been discussing. So the second point, which is the question 1B that we've been discussing, is so how do we internationalize the Whois data, essentially, the key point that we've been discussing. And from the various discussions, we seem to agree that we should separate the various data elements and discuss internationalization separately. So, for example, if you separate the current Whois output, we have the domain names. But, you know, the IDN standard already exists. I mean, the U label and A label already exist. Those are standardized. So we think those are probably enough to internationalize for the display of the domain name. So that's considered, you know, out of the scope here. So the next data item we discussed is the registrar. So in the regular Whois output, the registrar name is displayed. And we discussed about should we require... I think it requires a too strong a word. Should we recommend, the ASCII, the English representation, the English name of the registrar being displayed? And there has been some discussions, but it seems the party present at the call, at the couple of calls back, seems to agree that the registrar name could be one of those instances where we will want to have to display to display English at least. So, you know, the different Whois implementations could in addition to display the English, they could display their own, you know, for example, the Chinese name of the registrar or the Japanese name of the registrar. But we want to at least for them to display English. We talk about the postal address. We talk about the email address internationalization, and there are already requests for proposals in the IETF, the RFC 5336 about regarding the internationalization of email addresses. And we are studying that, and I think the consensus on the call was to use that as a way going forward to internationalize the email address. The telephone number, they're already the ITU standard E123 for internationalizing telephone numbers, and going forward, we will probably use that for internationalized telephone numbers. So those are the things that we've discussed, the entities. There are a couple of things that we haven't reached an agreement on. It's the key point is regarding the entity names. So that is the registrant name, the registrant contact information. And, something that the central point of the discussion is whether we should at least require an English representation of that. And there's no agreement on that yet. So that's my summary of the second point.
This is Julie. Thank you, Steve. So I'd like to open it up for questions on that summary.
Julie, it's Lisa. So just on that last point from Steve about the no agreement in relation to the entity name and registrant contact details, so how does that get moved forward? Is that still open for discussion by the working group?
Yeah, this is Julie. Yes, I think it is still open for discussion since we haven't come to an agreed upon recommendation for how we want to address that. Steve, you can correct me if you think that's...
Yes, I think so. Yeah, Julie, you're absolutely right.
Oh, yes, Lisa, this is Julie, that's an ongoing discussion. And certainly we welcome your ideas on that, as well as from Owen, since both of you have not had a chance yet to weigh in.
Briefly fill in some background. Essentially, there are two arguments, both for and against. So the argument for some kind of at least English representation is the WHOIS service is used to contact registrants, and many times those registrants are at a different country. And it's difficult. Right now it's in English, so it's a more commonly used language around the world. And it's easier. There's a high probability. Sorry, I'm not summarizing this very clearly. There's a high probability that, people will know English and therefore reach the registrant in question. So going to the internationalizing this information, so some working group members think that at least there should be an English representation. The argument against it is basically the premise that the status quo is unacceptable, in a sense that we're talking about internationalizing who is, and simply requiring one language, will present a kind of a barrier of entry for those registrants who do not know English. For example, in this case, for those registrants who do not know English, it will present them to them as a barrier of entry. And that, in turn, could lead to more inaccuracies in who is. So those are that's the argument against it.
Lisa,
do you
have a question or comment?
Yes, I understand that it's all about internationalizing, and I appreciate the difficulties of that, and you certainly don't want to come up with a set of recommendations that would be a barrier to anyone. I'm just wondering, though, the other core data that has been discussed and agreed should be available in ASCII. I presume that would be available in another language as well. Is that incorrect? Because it seems to me that the registrant information is in the same boat as a core piece of information that should be available in both ASCII and also perhaps another language as well.
This is Steve. I think the discussion is we recommended a minimum set of information to be included, and whether registrars or registries want to include additional information. For example, the registrar name. You know, we recommend they at least have English representation. If they decide to put whatever local language they are in, you know, we certainly don't prohibit that.
Oh, okay. I see.
So this is Jim Galvin. I have a question. Are we having a discussion about the postal, entity names and in terms of the requirements for them, or were you still just giving a summary and doing clarifications?
Yeah, we can talk about postal. I wasn't sure what we agreed on the postal address. I don't think we discussed very much on that. So.
Yeah, this is Julie. I was just looking through the notes from the last meeting, and I don't think that we had completed that discussion.
I'm sorry. I threw out an extra word there because you were talking about entity names and you had kind of stopped there and then you were having this discussion about requiring that it be in English, or at least you were talking about the two different sides of that. And so my question was, I didn't mean to drag postal into it, although I'm happy to do that too if you want. My question was really about, are we having a discussion about the requirements for entity names, or are you still just giving a summary?
I was just giving a summary, yeah.
Okay.
Right, yeah, this is Julie and Jim, and we were addressing Lisa's question since she hadn't been party to the previous discussion.
That's fine. I wasn't party to the previous discussion either, not the one that we had here anyway. This has been discussed many times, but that's fine. I won't engage if we're not engaging at the moment, so thank you.
Well, I that's a good question, Jim. This is Julie. Steve, since we've just done kind of a summary of this question, and there seems to be, more discussion we can have on question 1B. Should we? It's fine with me. What do you think? We could go ahead and just open up discussion on some of these items.
Sure.
So great, Jim. Then, if you've got some comments or questions, this is the time.
Okay, so, and I guess this applies both entity names and postal addresses in my view, but I know we go back and forth on this issue of does it need to be in English or should we allow people to do this in their local language? And I guess I'm wondering what our path forward is going to be for these things. You know, my concern is if we specify that things have to be in English, who gets to translate these things and make them be that way? And who's going to make sure that everything gets translated in a sensible way? And I would argue in favor of not requiring English because if you look at the way postal services around the world work today, there is a requirement, there's a standard for specifying that the country, right, so that you can get letters to countries. But past that point, the postal delivery that's written on an envelope can be whatever is okay for that local environment, that local country. And so I'm wondering why we would do anything different in this situation.
Jim, this is Steve. One reason that we might do different is because in the example of postal addresses, when a letter is sent, for example, from U.S. to Japan, a postman in Japan would pick it up, and he or she will have the knowledge of Japanese, so he knows where to deliver that address, to which address to deliver it to. But for who is, it's a different kind of inquiry method. For example, if an ISP in US want to find a registrant in Japan, there's no equivalent of a Japanese postman in this scenario. So the ISP in the US have to go all the way to find that registrant. That's my understanding.
Sure, but I'll be honest with you. I mean, sure, but I'll be honest with you. I find that argument specious. You know, I mean, there's no. You look at the way law enforcement works today. I mean, if they want to find someone in another country, there are well-developed channels for finding your way down to someone who can get you access to whatever it is you're trying to get to in another country. And I look at this situation and I think, well, if I get a Japanese name put in front of me, I know nothing about Japanese, but, you know, if I really want to find them, I'm going to find a solution to that problem, and that should be my problem, not yours.
Hi, this is Edmund.
Go ahead, Edmund.
Oh, okay. I have two comments on this, one comment on this and then something else on the email part. I kind of agree with Jim. However, perhaps the way we look at the issue is not so much in language. If we put it in the perspective of whether we want to, the way forward, whether we want to include some sort of backwards compatibility with who is, do we want to have some sort of ASCII representation of a certain contact? I think that might be a more fruitful discussion, because it seems to me that if we go down this particular direction, it's more of a political statement than something that we want as a who is to be a technical tool. In terms of you'd be the example of a U.S. ISP trying to find a Japanese registrant, I sort of agree with Jim on that in the sense that it's not the registrant's fault to not know English. I mean, if they don't know English, they should still be able to register a domain name. So perhaps the better, more fruitful direction is whether we want the future who is, which is internationalized, to have somewhat of a backwards compatibility, because right now we know that the who is takes only ASCII characters, and do we want to consider that being one of the features going forward is to have some backwards compatibility to the existing one. That was the first point. The second point was on emails. Apologize for not being on the call last time, but I understand that it's currently pointing towards the EAI specifications. However, I have been participating in that as well, but in there is a concept of downgrading from an internationalized name, and that downgrading happens in a, for lack of a better word, a sort of a handshake between the mail email protocol. That doesn't seem to be possible in terms of, or at least it's not envisioned in this sort of a who is environment. I wonder if that has been explored further.
Thanks.
So,
this is Steve. We are still exploring that.
Yeah, and this is Jim, and I'll just add that with respect to downgrading in EAI, I'm aware of some other discussions that are going on that suggest that downgrading is simply not going to happen, that there are just too many edge cases where you just cannot do it effectively and make it work in any kind of universal way. And an argument can be made that you don't need downgrading.
I know it's still a point that's open for discussion, so certainly there's been no consensus on this point, but I would suggest that we not get ourselves here wrapped up in a downgrading discussion, that downgrading discussion, because that will certainly have its own life in a different forum. Other than that, I agree with Edmund. I like the idea of, I mean, if it's possible, you provide an optional component for backwards compatibility, or I could even imagine, you know, a registrar, you know, maybe there is an opportunity for registrars to provide a point of contact that could be visible to people who would like some, you know, help in translation or access or something like that. I'm thinking if we focus specifically on law enforcement, since I brought them up before, you know, maybe part of the who is for a registrar to include an abuse contact at the registrar that can be easily contacted in, we have to decide what's a universal way. I mean, English is always the easy choice. Maybe there's something else, but the concept is still there.
Hi, this is Lisa. So can I just ask another question, and pardon my ignorance, but is it the case that the earlier pieces of information will be available in ASCII, but really you're just talking about treating the registrant information differently, not requiring that that's provided in ASCII? Is that correct?
What information? I'm sorry, did you? I the first word that you had there in your question kind of didn't come through for me.
Oh, sorry. It's the line's dropping in and out a bit. My understanding is the registrar information, the email address and the telephone number will be available in, the recommendation is that that would be available in ASCII. Is that correct?
No, I thought we said for the telephone, well, I guess ASCII is a relative term in this case, but Arabic in the case of the numbers, according to the E.123 standard.
Oh, okay.
And the email address would be whatever comes out of this EAI group for the standard for internationalized email addresses. Did I get that right, Steve?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Steve?
So maybe we come back around to the question I started with here when I raised my comment about entity and postal address about, you know, how, what is the path forward in this group to come to consensus on what to recommend on those two elements?
So this is Julie, and Steve certainly chime in, but I think we would envision trying to draft a set of recommendations on all of these items that we've identified, at least those that we, as the working group, believe are in scope of this working group, and some we may decide are not in scope. But for those that we feel that are in scope, staff can assist in drafting a set of recommendations for the working group to consider, and we can discuss, you know, adjustments to those and determine to which of those we agree. And recommendations that would go forward out of this group would be those on which we have reached consensus. The charter defines consensus as 2/3 of the working group members agreeing, and in the case in which there is disagreement, say 1/3 or less, there is the opportunity for including minority reports when the recommendations go forward, you know, indicating that these members, you know, X members agreed and X members, that is less than, you know, 1/3 or less, disagreed and why. And that would then, you know, move forward as a type of working group report.
This is Steve. Tuli, I think you summarized the procedure very well. For my sense is for other elements of internationalization, we probably, at least my sense is, people participated on the call seems to reach some kind of consensus. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. For the point that Jim raised, I just see it's essentially two camps, and I am not sure how to reach. I'm not sure how to reach consensus on that, to put it short. Yeah.
Mr. Edmund.
Oh, please go ahead, Edmund.
I believe we mentioned a few times in the past that about some postal standards. Is there any possibility to refer to that? I believe there was some study on that. Can you remind us what exactly those standards would look like if it's somewhat adopted?
Edmund, this is Julie. I know that Dave Piscatella, who unfortunately is unable to be on this call, had done a study of the Universal Postal Union standards and had put them out as a possibility for the group to consider, and we could certainly circulate those again to see if that might be an acceptable path forward in the case of postal addresses.
Okay, so that has been brought up. Has there been any objections against using such a standard?
This is Julie. I do recall that we had discussed it. I think it was two calls ago. I know that one of the issues that I believe it was Steve Metallitz raised was how the postal addresses could be, that they might not be able to be easily dealt with using computer automation, if I remember correctly. And Steve, do you recall what, I'd have to look back at my notes, what some of the other discussions were on postal addresses. I don't think we'd come to a conclusion on how to address them.
I don't remember that either.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think that's one, Edmund, that we probably need to get the discussion going again on and have, have Dave pull up what he sent around before, and perhaps what we can do is see if we can get a discussion going on that on the list as well. But another possibility, too, is to see if we can set out the things that we, and I know that Steve has been trying to do this, set out the things that we feel that we're reaching perhaps some agreement on, and then maybe list out the issues of, the questions we've discussed thus far and those that are remaining issues, such as the registrant information and the postal addresses and so on, and try to see if we can get a more pointed discussion on those items, maybe even just taking a couple of them, on a call and hashing through them a little bit more in detail.
This is Steve.
Steve, please.
I just took a look at Dave's presentation at SO on the postal address format. So let me briefly summarize. So the presentation, it says the Universal Postal Union International Address Formatting is the addressee's address should be written legibly in Roman letters and Arabic numerals. If other letters and figures are used in the country of destination, it shall be recommended that the address be given also in these letters and numerals. So essentially, what this is saying is, for example, if someone sends a letter from Great Britain to the UAE, which in principle means you write the address twice. You write once the address in Roman letters, which is essentially like in English. And you also write the address once in Arabic characters. So that's Dave's presentation on the UPU standard. So essentially, you know, I think essentially it's saying, you know, it requiring a English and also in another language.
Well, actually, I don't think that's required, because I thought the extra Arabic was optional.
Right, right. The extra Arabic is optional, so but the Roman numeral is required.
So this is Julie. So the requirement is, at the least, the address in Roman letters and Arabic numerals. Is that correct?
Yes, that's
with the option to also put that same information in a local script.
Yes.
Actually, I thought it was the other way around.
Go ahead, Jim.
I mean, I thought it was the other way around, that you're not required to put it out there in Arabic or Roman. They just recommend that.
Steve, this is Julie. Is it? We probably have to pull up the exact wording, but is it clear from Dave's presentation as to whether or not it's a requirement for Roman letters and Arabic numerals?
Well, I guess. Sorry, I think we can just pull up the slide, and then we can discuss about it.
Yeah, I'm looking for Dave's slides now.
So it's in the ESSAC presentations.
Oh, in the ESSAC presentations, I thought he gave an open.
Yeah.
But it is, because it's related to the ESSAC.
Okay.
Even though it was presented at an open meeting, it was related to an ESSAC issue. I mean, being that it's ESSAC and GNSO that are on this.
Yeah, I thought he had given the presentation in a Who Is Data Accuracy thing or something, but they don't have any. Oh, here we go. Maybe it's in here in the presentations.
It should be under the presentations. If it's posted. Yeah, internationalized data registration data webinar.
Yes.
Yes, and I have to get to the right.
Yeah.
Okay, thing is not organized. I have to know which day it's on in order to find the presentation. Okay, so it's on Wednesday afternoon.
Okay.
It was on Wednesday afternoon.
But there was also a webinar that was posted, webinar slides that were posted on the ESSAC website. I'm just looking through that. Okay, that might actually not have the UPU thing in it.
It does.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, let me send the working group.
Yeah, if you want. Oh, here, I have it. So it's slide 22.
Yeah, 21 and 22.
21 and 22. 21, Universal Postal Union International Address Formatting. The address shall be written legibly in Roman letters and Arabic numerals. If other letters and figures are used in the country of destination, it shall be recommended that the address be given also in these letters and numerals. And then there's an example on slide 22, the address of an item posted in Great Britain to the UAE will therefore in principle be written once in Roman characters, and it's recommended that it would also be written in Arabic letters.
Okay. I actually downloaded the PDF from the ICANN website, and it's actually slide 15 in that presentation.
Maybe slightly different, because we did this in two different places.
Right. Well, fair enough. So I got it exactly backwards, which is fine.
Okay.
But I see that this is what Dave wrote, so that's interesting, and it's fine.
Jim, I think.
What do you think about that as a possible,
right,
you know, recommendation to follow that standard with postal addresses in in internationalized registration data?
Well, I suppose my initial reaction is that was an interesting rule in days gone by. And frankly, my initial reaction is we've moved past that and it's time to reconsider that rule. That would be my going in position. I'm happy to be convinced otherwise, though.
This is Steve. I think we should put all the possible options on the table, and so we're not limited to UPU standards. I think whatever Jim proposed is, it's perfectly valid as well. So
yeah, I mean, I think the situation is different today than it was when these rules were written. I mean, you can rationalize this rule, as I think through this a little bit, and I apologize, I'm sort of thinking out loud a little bit here. You can rationalize this rule to suggest that this really was never a problem except for someone who was actually interacting internationally. And it would make sense to have a single method to move things around internationally. And it would be something which would be initiated in, to draw the analogy to where we are today, by the registrant themselves. They would initiate this contact. And so the idea that they might put it in some baseline that everybody understands makes sense to me. But we're actually in a different situation. The circumstances under which we're operating here are quite different. This is not about the registrant initiating discussions or conversation or visibility of themselves to anyone. This is about a pull model as opposed to a push model. And so I don't think that this rule applies as written. It doesn't apply directly. I don't want to close the door in discussion because maybe somebody will think of something else. But as I think about this, it's, the model under which we're operating today is different than the model under which this rule applies. That's where I'm coming from.
Got you.
It's Edmund. I'm not sure that it could be entirely the case. I don't think it's so much. It is sort of a push. It depends on how you see it. It is a push because if the registrant is deciding what information it wants to push out to the community, like to the world, and you can see it as a pool. If you are the viewer of the who is information, and you're looking for the actual information, so it depends on which view you're taking.
Well, I agree. Let me not get hung up on push versus pull, and try to describe this instead in terms of behavior and functionality, and just observe that. In at the time that this rule is in place, it's for a behavioral model whereby I am trying to initiate a communication in an international context, and therefore it seems reasonable for me to want to follow those rules. On the other hand, in the DNS world in which we are, I'm trying to establish some contact information with my local representative, if you will, the registrar. So I only need to be able to communicate with them, and the rest of the world is really not relevant and important to me. The fact that other people may have uses for some of the information that I'm going to give to my registrar is something I probably need to know, but it shouldn't be my responsibility to provide that information in a way that you can consume it. If you want that information, you should have to create a mechanism or a means by which you can get it in a format that's suitable for you.
So, Jim, let me see if I can summarize what you're saying. What you're essentially suggesting is an option that we don't require registrants to submit their WHOIS information or publish their WHOIS information in English. They can submit or publish in whatever languages they feel comfortable with. But we do want registrar to provide a point of contact. And if such issue, for example, a translation issue would arise where a registrant needs to get in touch with another registrant, the registrar point of contact would respond and provide the translated information. Is that, am I getting that correct or no?
Jeff, I mean, yes, the two things that you summarized correctly, but let me just clarify one thing. I was only offering as a suggestion that it would be, in the context of backwards compatibility, an alternative to requiring the registrant to also enter things in English. Another option might be for the registrar to translate it for the registrant, and that's what they put in the WHOIS. Another option, yet again, might be for the registrar to provide a point of contact that would provide, you know, translation services upon request, or perhaps for a fee, or perhaps as required by a local judicial authority. I guess what I wanted to clarify is that I'm not saying that I am offering that simply as a discussion point, not as something that I'm proposing.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Jim. This is Julie. So we'll try to capture those alternatives and present them as suggestions for discussion to the, you know, the rest of the members. What do you think about that approach, Edmund?
I think that makes sense. I'm still a little bit unsure what the UPU standards are. I was trying to search around what they are in more detailed format. Just that one slide and discussion might not give it the whole for lack of a better word, respect it should get, because I believe it. You know, I was just searching around and I see that it was formed in 2004. I'm sure it's relatively modern. The newest standard would be a relatively modern manifestation. I somewhat agree with, you know, the idea that in essence the registrar should be sort of a point man for the international world, and a local registrant should just be able to deal with their local situation. But I think in terms of how you describe the way forward, that's that works.
Thank you, Edmund. This is Julie. What we can also do is see if we can track down a little bit more detailed text on the UPU requirements. I'm sure that Dave has access to that. And I think that would be helpful.
Because that really, I think that would help us. I mean, I can imagine that they probably have some sort of standard for, you know, local mail as well. I don't know. Like, maybe if we adopt the whole thing and just point to that, then we have I wouldn't say more, but I'm just speculating here. But the thing is, if we have a standard to point to, I think it would help us a lot in terms of trying to come to a solid framework.
Great. Thank you, Edmund. This is Julie. I'm noticing in the detail, at least on one of the presentations that Dave did, that there are some additional elements to the requirements that it might be useful for us to capture. In particular, in addition to writing the addresses in Roman letters and Arabic numerals, it also has a requirement that the person addressing the piece of mail must comply with the recommendations of the postal authority of the country in which you post your items, as regards indication of the destination country, and you follow the recommendations of the destination country's postal authority for the remainder of the address elements, and that you always write the name of the destination country in one of the languages used in the country in which you post your items. This language is not an internationally known language. You should add the name of the destination country in an internationally known language. So there's several details there that perhaps we can pull out a little bit
because that seems to provide a few more options of capturing the information both in Roman letters and Arabic numerals, but also in the country's local script and language. So we'll take that as an action to maybe pull together a separate email string on the postal addresses and get some of this information out on the list and see if we can get some additional discussion on it. Is there more discussion on
that? Sounds good. And I think in terms of it, it might be fruitful to go down that path for also the contact name, because you know, there might be, because in the whole postal address, they probably also address the name of the recipient as well. And so.
Yeah, this is Julie. Thank you, Edmund. That's a good suggestion. That might be able to be a way of formulating some possible recommendations for some of the other elements, including the contact name. Have some further thoughts on this? Others on the call, and Jim?
Do others on the call have other suggestions, options of moving forward?
And then the postal elements or any of the other elements?
This is Lisa.
Yes.
I don't have any suggestions at the moment, but I'd love to have a look at the postal elements and then have a chance to think about it and come back and discuss it at the next call.
Thank you, Lisa. That's great. And Jim, how does this sound moving forward if we try to, you know, pull out some of these different alternatives and maybe a little bit more detail on the UPU standards for discussion?
Yeah, no, I agree completely, you know, and obviously I guess implicit in the way we've been talking about process here is and I want to say this out loud just so that people can say I've got it wrong if I'm wrong, that we are having discussions here and we're trying to collect a requirements document together, but ultimately it's going to have to go to the list, and it's the mailing list through which we're going to declare consensus and final discussion. And, you know, I guess I want to ask if that's true, but then I'll just say in response to your question to me, Julie, that sure, I agree completely to try to, you know, collect all this up and put it out to the list and see what other discussion we get from people.
Right. And to Jim, this is Julie, to answer your question. We will, of course, continue these discussions on the calls, and we'll try to get, you know, people to say yes or no, they agree or not on different items on the calls. But I think ultimately you're right. We'll probably ask for people to respond in one way or another, positively or negatively, to each of the recommendations we make as we craft them. We may be doing them in a piecemeal fashion as opposed to trying to go, you know, so we might pick the ones that, I think we'll probably pick the ones that we think we're getting close on and put those out there, and Steve has been trying to summarize them as we go along in any case. And then when we get to the point that we feel we have something fairly firm, you know, ask people, you know, do you agree or do you disagree, and, you know, and if so, what changes would you like to make, et cetera. And that certainly can happen on the list because we're unlikely to have everybody together on one call.
This is Edmund.
Yes.
This is a little bit separate from the discussion we had today, but I recall there was one thread that I believe it was Patrick Paulstrom bringing up the issue of variants and in variant domains in terms of IDN registrations. I was wondering, have we ever touched on the topic, or is this going to come up later on after we deal with some of these basic elements?
Hi, Edmund, this is Julie. I do remember seeing something on that, and Steve, you can chime in as well. I don't think, I'm just checking through the various questions that Dave has put out to see whether or not variance is an item that's captured there.
And I think, Edmund, this is obviously an issue, I think, as you know, that's come up, I think, in some of the other conversations about internationalized domain names. I'm not seeing variance in here as a point of discussion. Steve, do you recall around variance?
No, I don't. But we can, I can dig out that email, and we can discuss it next time, I guess.
Yeah, I think we should try to capture that one. I think there are potentially a lot of issues there that we may or may not, we may decide are not in the scope of this group, but I think they need to be fleshed out. Thank you, Edmund. That's a good point. And so suggesting a way forward, we'll summarize this discussion and pull out the Postal Union standards information and some details there, and also pull, you know, put together some possible alternatives for dealing with some of these elements. And but also so that people know, we put together some draft slides, and Edmund, we sent those to you and Jeremy the latter part of last week, I think it was. Might have been on Thursday. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at them, but we do have an opportunity to give an update on the IRD WG work and actually it went on Thursday the 25th. I sent it around. At the ESAC open meeting in Nairobi. That will be in Nairobi from 2 o'clock to 3:30 on Tuesday the 9th. I will send information on that and other related meetings to this list probably later today or tomorrow morning. Edmund, did you... Just if you could, when you get a chance, maybe send around any comments you have on those slides.
Sure, yes, I did get it. In terms of my schedule to Nairobi, I will know for sure tomorrow whether I will actually be in Nairobi. If I am there, I'll definitely be able to make a presentation. If I'm not going to be there, then perhaps it might be more useful for somebody who would be there to give the presentation. That's
yeah. So we'll try to see if we can work that through. There's not very many people, very very few people from this working group will be there. I think it's yourself. You may or may not be there. Excuse me. Andre said he'll be there, and Avery. Excuse me, we'll be there in Rom also. I think that's all I'm aware of at this point. But we'll try to...
And if you want me to do it remotely, in the case where I won't be there, I'm happy to do that too, but...
Well, let's wait and see.
Perhaps
if...
I'll know in about 20 hours and... I'll respond.
Great. And if you could, in the meantime, obviously not now since it's 4 o'clock in the morning for you, but if you, tomorrow, whatever, could get a chance to look at the slides in any case and just let us know what you think, if there are any changes, that would be great. And then we'll wait to hear from you and we'll try to work out, perhaps an alternate to give the presentation if you're not able to go.
Sure.
Thank you, everyone. We're now 5 minutes after the hour. I apologize, but I wanted to deal with some of those logistical issues. Are there any questions or anything that we have missed that I should mention or address? Then thank you, everyone. We will not have a meeting in Nairobi, given that there will be so few working group members in Nairobi, and the time difference makes it very difficult to try to have a call and have people join. But we'll resume our regular schedule of calls after Nairobi. But in the meantime, we'll try to keep the discussion going on the list. Thank you, everyone.
And welcome again to Owen and Lisa. Thanks for joining us, and thanks, Jim, for all your great input as well, and Edmund for chairing. And if I don't see you in Nairobi, we'll hear you on next call.